I'm Christine Genier. This is Words and Culture.
Words and Culture is made possible with funding from SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Words and Culture is produced by Kim Wheeler. Kaylin Belair is our audio engineer and editor.
Onigiwahi.
Gigawabamin.
Soko seni denit e. Ninen yuji hina.
Ekose.
Kakuhutau. We'll see you again.
Hello and welcome to Viewpoints. My name is Boris Chassay and I'll be with you for the next half hour. On this week's show, we'll have housing, education, and adventure movies on our plate. A Sackville resident is challenging the allowable size of homes in the New Brunswick-Tantramar region to make it possible to have more tiny homes built.
This particular amendment was to create opportunities and possibilities for those folks that are interested in small footprint housing that can't find local carpenters since they are so busy to create 20-foot by 20-foot squares, but would rather have a small footprint rectangle built off-site and then brought into our municipality.
The Aurora Adventure Film Festival returns with a new crop of feature films highlighting thrill seekers from around the globe.
Because it's an opportunity to meet people who've done these incredible and crazy things around the globe, how they've done it, and to ask them the questions you want to ask them. How have these people done these things that seem so far out of reach?
Senior Women Living Together, a new not-for-profit organization, matches women seeking housemates to counter solitude and the rising cost of living.
4 years after my husband died, I found myself looking at my finances and my savings. So I knew I was going to be homeless at some point unless I did something.
And the stand-up comics Deadly Aunties provide bursaries to Manitoba and Ontario University students. Welcome to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.
On the air with Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
Nice to have you with us. We kick things off in Ontario, where the globe-trotting Aurora Adventure Film Festival is back for a second year and continues to grow with even more offerings. The Aurora Adventure Film Festival, held from November 7th to the 10th, will feature films highlighting thrill seekers from around the globe, along with the speaker series with three well-known adventure travelers. Festival founder Ian Evans says they knew they wanted to bring back the festival after an extremely successful inaugural year. Evans says cultural events in Aurora are always supported by the community. A South Pole explorer himself, Evans says this year will include 20 films in total from far and wide. Arlene Dowell, based in Fergus, Ontario, has that story for us.
A successful film festival in Aurora is back for a second year and continues to grow. The Aurora Adventure Film Festival has returned and will feature films highlighting thrill seekers from around the globe. This year, the Aurora Adventure Film Festival will include the popular two-program schedule at the Gorge Cinema and a speaker series at the Aurora Center for the Arts November 7th through the 10th. Festival founder Ian Evans says they knew they wanted to bring the festival back after an extremely successful inaugural year. Evans says, you know, if you put on a cultural event in Aurora, you will get support.
I realized what a wonderful event it is for a small town when it brings communities from outside in and adds to the whole social scene of that community. And I thought about Aurora, I thought about the timing, I thought of the other events we have here, such as the Festival Singers, Riverfest, the cinema, et cetera, and the Art Center. And what a wonderful fit a film festival in November would be into that social infrastructure.
An adventurer himself, Evan says this year will include 20 films in total, ranging in length from far and wide.
In this festival, there are adventure films from around the world that have been seen in other festivals or are brand new or we've sought out. So none of the films are from my adventures. I'd much rather have it that way. There has been a major documentary film made of my South Pole expedition. It's called Lunatic, suitably. It showed in all the local cinemas, and we toured on the festival circuit with it a few years ago. And that's really where I got this feeling about an adventure film festival for Aurora. When we saw what that did and the fun we had with Lunatic traveling around Europe.
The films were chosen by Evans and his wife, with their goal being to cover off a wide range of adventures and emotions.
We spend many hours looking at films, looking at the programs, and we try to design the program so that it fluctuates and moves. In other words, you've got a really extreme adventure, then you've got something inspirational, then a short film, then a longer film. And so it really ebbs and flows as the program goes on. But we've got programs from, we've got films from people who are 70 or 80 and young kids doing adventures and families and extreme adventurers. So, and we've covered off water sports, we've covered off climbing, cycling, running, kite surfing from all around the world, these really interesting locations.
Evan says he hopes the films and speaker series inspire people to embark on an adventure of their own. During his many public speaking engagements, you will find Evans concentrating on the message that there is adventure waiting for everyone. Evan says he is just a regular guy.
I feel like I'm an ordinary guy. I've got an ordinary background. I'm a chartered accountant. I've had a career, a regular life, a family, traveled around the world. But on the other side, I've managed to have a secondary life where I can push myself to the edge of what I call my comfort zone and right to the edge of it sometimes and beyond. And I've managed to achieve things. And I always say that everyone can do this. Anyone can cycle across Australia. If you can ride your bike, if you can cook dinner, if you can put your tent up and you can do it again the next day, you can bike across Australia. Yes, you've got to do it 60 times in a row, but you can do it. So break it down and do that. So those are the things that I bring to this and hope to parlay to people that are listening.
With the addition of the speaker series this year, Evan stresses there is room for even more growth.
What we really want this to be is a complete adventure festival weekend. So it's not just for films. This year we've expanded to a speaker series, an adventure speaker series at the Arts Center. And also we've got more screenings, but I want to expand it into maybe a bike ride and a run and things like that. So to really make it a community event that's adventure related.
The cost of the film program is a $20 flat fee.
That gets you into one of the programs. So it's a 2.5 hour program where there's an hour of adventure films, a break for 20 minutes or so. Which is a wonderful part of the event for people to mingle and talk about the films, then another hour of films, and then we break up at the end of that. So that's what you'll get for $20. The speaker series, where adventure speakers are speaking live at the Art Center, they're $12 per event. And I think people are interested in that because it's an opportunity to meet people who've done these incredible and crazy things around the globe, how they've done it, and to ask them the questions you want to ask them. How have these people done these things that seem so far out of reach?
Film programs, speaker series, and ticket information is all available at AlloraAdventureFilmFestival.ca. Arlene Dowell with the Local Journalism Initiative.
You're on the air with Viewpoints.
As landlords continue to raise rental prices across the country, many renters are being left behind. According to rentals.ca, the average rent in Canada has increased by 25% since 2021. For some, the result is homelessness, and the Waterloo region is no exception. Pat Dunn, a widowed retiree now living in Peterborough, is the founder and executive director of the nonprofit organization Senior Women Living Together. Through subscriber-generated profiles, the organization finds matches for senior women who then meet up to discuss living as housemates. The organization is currently promoting their free service in the Waterloo region. Dan Keller, based in Kitchener, Ontario, spoke with Pat Dunn, who talks about her own brush with homelessness and how this led her to help others in the same situation. Here's part of his conversation with Mrs. Dunn.
My name is Pat Dunn. I'm a retired public health nurse, and I am the founder and executive director for Senior Women Living Together. we need to get a sort of critical mass of subscribers in any one area. So we're going around the province, community by community, promoting what we do. So what happens is that once women join our website, they can start to look for compatible homemates, other women that they would like to live with. And then together, they form a homemate group of maybe 2, 3, 4 women. And together, they look for a place to live, and that makes it affordable for each of them. And then they each have as much privacy and as much togetherness as they choose to have.
How do the houses that are being found for residents, are they owned by one of the women in the group, or is it a mix of options?
Yeah, it's a mix. We have homeowners that come and join us because they are also having difficulty meeting their financial needs for mortgages or for improvements or upkeep on the house. And also they're tired of living alone and they'd like to have some company. Only about 5% of our members are homeowners. So we have homeowners that come, but most of our members are not. They're currently renting and living alone and looking for, a better option financially and that has social support. And we help the homemade groups find affordable housing by partnering with private landlords. So a private landlord, we'd work with the private landlord to fill their house or their property with senior women who will live together. And then we replace anyone who has to leave the unit. And so that frees the landlord up. The landlord gets excellent tenants. Plus, we manage the relationships in the house. They don't have to worry about that. And we manage the turnover over time.
With an ongoing housing crisis, why focus on senior women?
There's nothing available, there's nothing affordable, and it's not just affecting seniors, it's affecting all age groups. So it's a big mess. It came out of my experience. 4 years after my husband died, I found myself looking at my finances and my savings was just dwindling at a really rapid rate just to give me a roof over my head. So I knew I was going to be homeless at some point unless I did something. So that's how I got started with this. And it sort of was my vision initially, but now we have a board of directors and a nonprofit organization. And so we are hoping to be sustainable for a very long time for other women.
Has the organization been successful in other areas?
Yeah, I mean, we've had 60 women find compatible homemates and start living together. And that was through COVID when many women were not going out to meet anyone in person. And so it's starting to build again. Now that people can start to meet in person, it is very important to meet many times together before you decide to live together. It's a big step to take. So we encourage and help with the arranging of meetups and that sort of thing. So the women can start to get to know one another.
So beyond the needs for shelter, it's also building up community and relationships.
Yes, exactly. What we found, I mean, my initial fear, of course, was homelessness was financially related. But as I got talking with other senior women in the same situation, I realized it wasn't going to be a really safe way to go into my aging process living alone. And I was acknowledged finally to myself that I was lonely. I don't need a lot of social support around me, but it's great to have it. And if it's right there at your fingertips, then, if I fall, somebody's going to be there. They're going to help me and get me to the next stage and so on. And it just takes away all the fears around aging.
What does success look like for your organization in Waterloo Region?
Well, we're hoping that through our 3-month sort of launching us out into the region, a 3-month program that we were instituting, and we hope to get you know, lots more subscribers, hopefully enough that it meets that kind of critical mass in that area so that homemade groups start forming. Because you need to talk with, you know, 4 or 5, sometimes 10 women before you find one woman that you want to live with. And so it's fairly complex, and it does take 3 to 6 months for homemade groups to form. We can't help women in urgent need of housing. That the agencies, they have to go to the agencies for that.
And is there any cost to the folks taking part in the program?
No, it's completely free. We're a nonprofit corporation. We're not in this for the money. Although we do have expenses, it's not cheap to run a good website, especially one with kind of functionality that we have. We have a donation drives, and we invite anyone and everyone to donate. We also seek grant money and have received some grants from the Canadian Women's Foundation and the New Horizons for Seniors program. And so we can continue to look for grant money and donations.
That was an interview with Pat Dunn, the founder and executive director of the not-for-profit organization Senior Women Living Together.
Do you have questions or comments? Our email is radio@frequencynews.ca.
A Sackville resident is asking the New Brunswick Tantramar Council to change the way it regulates the size of dwellings. She hopes to make small homes or tiny homes more practical. Sackville dwellings must, as of now, have minimum dimensions of 20 feet by 20 feet, which is too wide for buildings to be constructed off-site and transported on provincial highways to their final destination. So Natalie Donaher is proposing to allow for rectangular-shaped small homes to be built elsewhere and moved to Sackville. Donaher believes that her proposal could be part of a municipal plan review, which could be achieved by 2026, but the affordable housing advocate decided to apply for this change immediately. I didn't think we should wait that long, she says, because it seems the housing crisis is much more urgent than that, adds Donaher, who spoke with Erica Butler in Sackville, New Brunswick.
Tiny homes are growing in popularity as a solution to the high cost of building and housing, but in Sackville, land use bylaws limit how small an individual dwelling can be, and they even limit the shape. Currently, dwellings in Sackville must have a minimum footprint of 20 feet by 20 feet. That square shape creates practical challenges for building units off-site and then transporting them to their final location. And it's something Tantramar Council will have a chance to change, thanks to Sackville resident Natalie Donaher. At their Committee of the Whole meeting on Monday, Tantramar Council heard Plan 360 planner Jenna Stewart present Donaher's proposed change. Remove the 20-foot by 20-foot minimum in Sackville's bylaw and replace it with a 400-square-foot limit. Stewart explained that the square shape requirement was likely an aesthetic choice to prohibit homes that looked like mobile homes, which are otherwise defined in the bylaw.
So normally when we see these text amendments go through, there's an interested developer who has a project in mind, and it's all part of a business plan.
Right.
But this is something different. Tell me how this has come about.
I don't have a particular business plan, but I am interested in smaller footprint housing. I've been working with some nonprofits in the last year and a half. And this particular amendment was to create opportunities and possibilities for those folks that are interested in small footprint housing that can't find local carpenters since they are so busy to create 20-foot by 20-foot squares, but would rather have a small footprint rectangle built off-site and then brought into our municipality. And as it stands, 20 feet by 20 feet would prohibit anything from being brought on the roads. So we have some very skilled builders in the local vicinity, maybe 100 kilometers nearby or closer, and they cannot be hired by any of our municipality citizens to build housing on lands or lots that they buy in town with this particular restriction. So this was to allow, hopefully, folks to find builders sooner. And I'm sure this sort of idea would have been considered with the bylaw changes that are impending, but I didn't think we should wait that long because it seems the housing crisis is much more urgent than that, and so that's why I brought the application forward.
Yeah. Because otherwise we'd be waiting for a review of our whole municipal plan, so it could be years long, basically.
Yes, they are anticipating a review to be done by 2025, 2026, but the housing crisis is only ever increasing. And I've been speaking to and listening to stories in the last 2-3 months of instances of individuals who are having a difficult time finding housing here that would like to move to our community and can't find apartments, especially those with animals or potentially small budgets for whatever reason. So this might fill that need. And I'm hopeful that it goes through on second reading.
There is application fees involved with this sort of text amendment, which is why usually you see it coming from developers who have a business interest. So did you fundraise for this, or how are you making that work?
The timeline was quite short for the turnaround to make it to today's meeting, so I paid out of pocket. And I am in talks with community groups who are interested in fundraising for this fee, but at the moment I just paid it.
How much is it?
It's $1,500.
I gather, you know, going from 2020 to 400, and 400 you've chosen because that's the area limit now. There are tiny homes that are smaller than 400 square feet. So are you concerned that, you know, we'll make this text amendment, but there's still a limit baked into it?
There is, but because the 2025-2026 review is coming up, I think we'll have a longer timeline to consider the aspects of changing those 400 square feet to something even smaller, which might align with our town's priorities and which may not. But that's right, the 12 neighbors community that was stated during the council meeting is much smaller footprint than what we are introducing, or what I would hope to introduce for the text amendment. So it is an excellent transitional community example, but it is not what today's amendment was aimed to reproduce here. We are just essentially changing the dimensions of housing instead of the square footage. And 400 square feet is a cottage-sized building. They often call them that instead of a tiny house, since I think 400 square feet for the enthusiasts of tiny houses, they would say that's not tiny anymore. So we're just doing cottage-sized spots. Yeah,
this is a mansion by tiny home standards.
400 square feet, 450 square feet would be a mansion by tiny house standards. And they are often 400 square feet, 450 square feet is often used by multiple levels of government to assess livable sizes for housing grants. So that's why I had it in my head to just change basically where it may be built. So the restriction of having it built on site rather than off site, and then the road dimensions, you know, we're logistically hemmed in to rectangles of a certain size if we intend to apply for any of the federal or hopefully provincial grants that may be available for housing, and then having it built by someone off site who may be available to do so with a quick turnaround, and then have them brought to somewhere within the community.
That's Sackville resident Natalie Donaher, who has taken a step towards making Sackville's land use bylaws more friendly to small home development.
Okay, man, let's go.
Okay.
Hello, I'm Candace Vetter in Embrun, Ontario, and you're tuned into Viewpoints. Follow us on X at Frequency News. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
Sherry McKay and Stephanie Panguish, both members of the Deadly Aunties comedy group, have teamed up to create a $2,000 bursary to be split between two university students. They drew inspiration to create the bursary from their desire to give back to their communities and from their shared experiences as mothers while moving through post-secondary education. The bursary is available to any Indigenous post-secondary student who lives in Manitoba or Ontario. Applicants will, however, have to share how humor has helped them during their healing journey. McKay and Panguish will choose the bursary recipients on November 8 and hope to create more of them. Capanese Thibault in Winnipeg, Manitoba, met up with the comic duo.
Sherry and Stephanie created a bursary available to university students. They drew inspiration to create the bursary from wanting to give back to their communities and their shared experiences of being mothers while going through post-secondary schooling.
So Sherry and I have always, ever since, you know, the Deadly Aunties started, we've always been wanting to give back to community. What we did before is when we put on shows, we would look for local Indigenous programming that's not technically funded by government or doesn't have too many supports, financial supports. So what we did is we started doing fundraisers at our shows and just gave all the money to like Indigenous youth programming. And there was some over here that we donated to. There was some in Ontario that we donated to. And we just always wanted to give back to community.
The bursary kind of came from, you know, Stephanie and I, we were both post-secondary students and moms, and we know the struggle. And man, you know, sometimes you have to pick between like rent and food or power and water and stuff like that. So we just wanted to kind of create something, just a little something that could help alleviate those things for some of the post-secondary students out there. And we're not backed by any government funding or anything like that. Like, this is coming out of Deadly Auntie's pockets. Not that it means any less if it was, because, you know, we have to find a way to help each other and help ourselves. And but I just mean like that this is coming from us. And if we have a way in the future to tap into other resources so that we could have bigger bursaries would be, you know, awesome. Or so that we could have more, because right now where, you know, the bursary is just offered, it's two bursaries, $1,000 each.
Mm-hmm.
So one person in Ontario, that's where Stephanie represents, and then me in Manitoba. So I know a lot of people are like, oh, I wish we had this in Alberta or yeah. Saskatchewan. And
we're like, no. It's hard to even offer this just to Ontario and Manitoba because we get a lot of applicants.
The bursary and the eligibility requirements can be found on the Deadly Auntie's website with more information included.
Check out our website.
Yeah, that's where the bursary is and all of the other information, eh?
Yeah.
www.thedeadlyaunties.com.
November 8th is the deadline.
Yeah, November 8th is the deadline.
So eligibility is, you must be a post-secondary student, Indigenous post-secondary student. So we're going to ask for qualifications on that. You must attend and reside in Manitoba or Ontario. And you must, you know, share with us how humor has helped you on your healing journey.
With Stephanie and Sherry being pioneers in the industry as Indigenous women, it hasn't always been easy for them, given comedy is a very male-predominated industry. Here are some words and wisdom that they have to share for beginner comedians.
We need more Native female comedians out there. And Stephanie, I don't want to speak for Stephanie, but my DMs are always open when people have questions, and I always try my hardest to answer them and help people. If it's like, you know, I want to go to an open mic, would you come with me? You know, or like, would you support me? And I'll do my best. And Stephanie has actually been there for me during the beginning of my process because she's got more experience than me. So
I think be yourself. Also, you know, trust your instincts. Trust your instincts when you're around people. That energy doesn't lie. Because as soon as you pick up on those vibes, just get out of there. Because, you know, in the end, you either learn from that way or learn the hard way, you know. And I've had to learn the hard way myself. Mm-hmm. So I ended up working with people that, you know, acted like my brothers and sisters, but then turned around and they weren't. So now I understand what they mean about trusting your instincts. Like, that's kind of like a message from, you know, maybe the spirit world. I don't know. Maybe creator. I have really no clue. But understand, you know, and trust the process. Trust the process. Be yourself. Find your authentic voice, because that's what people want to hear. People want to relate to your most authentic self. Don't try to imitate other people. Like, let your walls down. Enjoy the moment, because like, it's all love in the end, you know. People come there to see you. And so when you're up there, your most authentic self, you know, telling your stories that relate to you, just like, enjoy those moments.
Don't forget your purpose, and don't forget why you want to get into that, and all of the cool things that you can do, and all of the cool people you can meet and help along the way.
That's it for us at Viewpoints. Thanks to our reporters Erica Butler, Capenais Thibault, Dan Keller, and Arlene Dowell, national editors Victoria Fenner, and the newest addition to our team, national editor Conrad Fox. Viewpoints is produced by the Community Radio Fund of Canada with the support of the Local Journalism Initiative. I'm Boris Chassagne, your host and producer. Thanks for keeping us company this week, and until the next, ciao.
Questions or comments? Our email is radio@frequencynews.ca. radio@frequencynews.ca.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of Plugged in My Ears. My name is Sam. I'm joined by my lovely co-host, Kyle Nadam, again. This week, there's a lot on the go. I think we'll start the episode off speaking a little bit about U Sports. Last week, we tried to interview my little sister, Jiggy, and her teammate, Kylie, who play on the Queens women's rugby team, but there were some technical issues with the radio. And anyways, it didn't work, but I have a few updates. They went to Nationals at the University of Prince Edward Island this past week, and they did okay. They walked over Acadia and won 68-0 in the first game, and then that qualified them to skip right ahead to the semifinals where they played UVic. Unfortunately, they lost against UVic in what was a really tight game. It could have gone either way. Both teams are pretty similar. They both have two Olympians on their team. A lot of people, including the commentators on CBC Sports, felt as though the referees may have handed that game to the University of Victoria. Bit difficult to say. Of course, we come off as biased because we're from Queens. But it's okay because Queens ended up winning third place. They beat UOttawa in the finals in the bronze medal game. But the controversy of the tournament actually came from the University of British Columbia playing against the University of Victoria in the finals. UBC ended up winning the game with just a few minutes left. But the problem stems from the fact that most of UBC's team is significantly older than the players on UVic, and people were really unhappy about this. Now, they didn't break any rules, but it is a dynamic of U Sports. We were talking about this before we started the interview. Adam, I know that you said that you've known someone in track, or that you knew someone in track who was older, but maybe you can speak a little bit more to the dynamics of having older players who have competed in the Olympics, perhaps on multiple occasions on a team, and playing against them or racing against them.
Yeah, no, personally, I haven't raced against anyone or raced with anyone that is an Olympian, but there was an athlete a few years before me that was one of the female cross-country athletes, and she went to UBC Okanagan, and she was actually an Olympian before, so she went to school, did like 4 years, and in U Sports, you have your 5 years of eligibility, and then she went pro, played ran at the Olympics, and then decided to come back for one more year after already going pro and setting all these Canadian records. And then she won the individual title and helped UBCO at the U Sports Cross Country Championships. And there wasn't a lot of pushback to this because technically she was playing by the rules, even though I think she believed she was 28 or 29 at the time. But it's just a little bit of a loophole that, I mean, you don't even see that in American sports, because in American college sports, like you if you're over, like, well, technically they just have, they used to be a lot more strict on their eligibility rules. Now it's kind of getting out of hand. I mean, you see it in college football. You got like 27-year-old quarterbacks that have taken like two redshirt years, full years of injury, allegedly, and then they don't use their eligibility. And then with COVID, it got all screwed up with how many years of eligibility people actually have. It's like a whole messed up situation now, but it is very valuable to have players that have experienced sport on such a high level, such as the Olympics. I mean, like for those athletes on UBC's rugby team, I'm sure it was just like, oh, another day in the park. Like we've played in the Olympics. This is nothing, right? Like, I don't know, like pressure wise, I don't think that they even like had a glimpse of the same amount of pressure that they had in the Olympics. So being able to bring like that kind of calming tone to a team of young people kind of trying to aspire to get to the level that they are already at, I mean, it's clearly an advantage. And I mean, you can't blame them for having that kind of advantage. And it clearly worked out for them too. I mean, that's congratulations to UBC. That's a huge title. You also kind of see the strength of British Columbia rugby. I mean, UVic and UBC in the final is definitely I can't say we didn't see it coming, because I mean, we've talked about it on here before how BC has like their longer seasons and.
Yeah, well, BC's more acclimated to rugby. I mean, people always tend to forget that Rugby Canada is pretty much headquartered out of British Columbia now. I mean, anytime the national team plays in Canada, unless it's at Lansdowne in Ottawa, it tends to be in BC. And if it's against a good team like New Zealand, it is most definitely going to be in BC. But the big controversy, at least from the perspective of the Queens team, is that Queens' oldest player, I think, is 24. And they're a master's student, which is a bit different. But in fairness, you're right. This is still following the rules of the game. I don't know. Kyle, what do you think about all this?
I mean, it's a bit odd given that, like I know in hockey, like U-Sports hockey, a lot of players are really pretty old, actually.
Because they all come from the OHL.
Yeah, because just how it works, right? Like, so it's a bit of a different kind of scenario. Like, I know Queens U-Sports, at least, like, our hockey team, I think the average age is, like, 24 or 25. So it's a little bit different. But, yeah, if you got one team that's, like, all people that are in their late 20s versus, like, people that are 18 or early 20s, that's kind of, yeah, that's a bit interesting. I mean, it kind of makes you wonder their motivations, because U-Sports runs pretty differently than NCAA. Like, we, you know, there's not that much money to be made out there. So I don't know. I guess they're just doing what they want to win. I think it might be just a coaching thing.
Maybe. I mean, honest. The national team's head coach is UBC's coach. So there is certainly a lot of play in that capacity. But yeah, it does make you wonder what exactly is going on.
If you want to win, you're going to make sacrifices like that and just make the team the best it can be.
Yeah, although in fairness, Queens kind of did a similar thing. I mean, Chloe Daniels, granted she's 21 years old, took 2 years off university to go train for the Olympics and now came back and played for Queens. So maybe there shouldn't be so much complaining. But well, let's move on to other things. Let's move on to the NHL. Adam, I'll pick your brain a little bit here. Montreal's not doing so hot. They seem to be giving up close to 10 goals every game now. Cole Caulfield's playing okay, though. I don't know. What are your thoughts on Montreal so far?
Yeah, I think it's embarrassing. I hope they turn it around by next week when I go to watch a game in Montreal, but I'm not too optimistic that that's going to be the case. I don't know what's going on. The defense looks horrendous. They allow too many goals. The goaltending looks shaky. Mm-hmm. Cole Caulfield looks fantastic, which I love. 16 points. That's awesome for me. I mean, I love Cole Caulfield. He's a great player. He's a great scorer, but I mean, he can't do it all by himself. I mean, it's like McDavid, if McDavid was playing with a bunch of like peewee players. But I mean, I don't know, Nick Suzuki, and I mean, just guys that there were so many high expectations for have just kind of not shown up, especially on the defensive side of things. I know Arbor Jack guy's gotten criticized a lot for his rough play and dirty hits, and Caden Gooley hasn't really turned into that number one defenseman that Montreal was hoping he would turn into. But yeah, I don't know. The issue, like, usually, I mean, Montreal is pretty good defensively. Even last year, they weren't terrible.
Didn't give them any goals.
They weren't terrible defensively. It was the scoring, the lack of scoring that was the issue. And now it's just like, I don't know if this is just, I'm really hoping this is a stint and they can get this sorted out early in the season. But it's just not a good way to start the year. Doesn't, like, bring a lot of confidence to the team. I mean, I feel like this is how like the Senators have started the last few years. So maybe you guys can relate a little bit, but I don't know. This is, I mean, at this point it's same old because like Montreal sucks, but it sucks even more because I had such high expectations for the team going into this year. And
did you actually think they were out of the rebuild this year?
No, I didn't think they were out of the rebuild, but I thought they were going to
transition
be
up.
Better than last year. So, like, I think last year they improved by 10 points over 2 years ago. So I was another 10-point gap would get them to, like, 84 points, which obviously isn't good enough for the playoffs, but it's still a step in the right direction. It doesn't look like a step in the right direction right now. So I'm really hoping it's a stint. But, I mean, they're not even losing to good teams. They're losing to bad teams, which is even worse, like Pittsburgh. Oh, my goodness. So you're telling me they're losing to the Penguins? The Penguins are god-awful right now. Like, I don't know. It's a headache. Makes me not want to watch them. But,
yeah,
you know.
I saw something on Twitter that was actually a recording of Montreal being forced to do a bag skate on the road.
Yeah. Really? Because they were playing bad?
I mean, good on them. Like, what else are you going to do? Like, you can't praise that kind of behavior and just say, oh, it's part of the rebuild. Like, you can to an extent, but they're playing so bad.
Honestly, I blame that on the veterans because they don't seem to have that stability that veteran players are supposed to be bringing right now.
Yeah, I agree.
Those their older players are actually the
liabilities.
They've been almost the only thing that's like have nothing positive to say about them because they've been playing pretty poorly.
Yeah. I agree with you.
So I think it's another year where they're just going to develop their players a little more, keep rebuilding, and they know they need to target some better veteran defensemen specifically.
Well, in fairness, I actually don't think Lane Hudson and Logan Mailloux are bad. I think those guys might be the future of that decor.
Lane Hudson's been fantastic. Like, you can't complain about him. He hasn't scored a goal yet, but he's got like 9 assists.
No, he's great.
So he's got.
Well, actually, okay. I will say one thing, if I may. Sorry, I don't mean to interrupt you.
Yeah.
Defensively, I think that he still has some holes, but maybe that's just because he's young.
That
can be fixed.
And I also think he's focused so much on the offensive side of his game that the defensive side is going to naturally be lacking a little bit. And the idea with him was that they put him on a line with David Savard, who's supposed to be this defensive defenseman. And I guess he just wants to let all these goals in. Like he's not playing defensive hockey. He's like a turd out there.
On the pond.
I can't skate very well and I can't play, but I think I could play better than David Savard. Right. I think it's really.
He might
be Darnell Nurse of the Month.
Yeah.
Darnell Nurse of the Month. Is that something we're awarding now on this podcast?
No. I'll tell you someone right now who's taking the cake on that. There's some pretty weird phenomenon with having a bad D partner, because on the Senators right now, we're actually having a situation with Travis Hamonic, who has been god-awful for the last couple of years, but he has taken it to another level this year. I don't know what this guy's on. He's playing with Jake Sanderson as his D partner, and Jake Sanderson is clearly one of the best defensemen in the league. Like, he is easily top 20, top 15 defensemen in the league. And somehow Hamonic has made it is so bad. He's dragging Sanderson's like everything down. Like, he's like, I always talk about these scorecards. Like, I'm like, the betting apps do these scorecards, like performance above expected or under expected. Mm-hmm. Ever since Zub got injured and Sanderson's been playing with Hamonic, Sanderson has been consistently at the bottom of the team, and the only person that is significantly lower than him is Hamonic every time.
Well, you know what? It's funny you say that. I think, I mean, unconfirmed reports suggest that Hamonic may or may not have gone out of a pink Prius hybrid and gone picked up some tofu at the store, so it might be related to that.
I don't know. Yeah, I haven't heard any of those rumors, but I don't know. I mean, my point is you can just see how, like, a really bad D partner can switch up everything, right? I know Bouchard isn't known for his excellent defensive plays, and that's why they put Ekholm, who's like the like standard for really structured and.
Actually,
you
know, I'd say he might be defensive. The NHL standard for the most structured defenseman at the moment.
And he's been getting points too.
Yeah,
at the end of last season, a lot of people there was actually an argument made about how they need to rethink how they do like defenseman awards in the league. Because right now it's structured the same as the forwards, like, oh, who has the most points? Like, we'll give him the award. But if you look at like Ekholm's stats at the end of last regular season, he was like plus 50, and he had like I want to say he had like 50 points, maybe 60 points, and he had just like his stats were just off the charts. Like, he clearly had been playing like insanely good defensive hockey,
yeah,
which doesn't get rewarded in terms of.
Especially for a guy who's on PK1, who plays all the last 4 minutes of every game if they're up by a goal. It's true. That's one thing I've always found interesting as well. We tend to only prioritize offense. Like, if you look at the average person who's drafted out of the OHL, the NCAA, who's a defenseman, they're not drafted because of their defensive merit. They're drafted because of their offensive ability and the ideas that they will hopefully become good defensemen. Mm. But it's kind of a gamble. And so what actually ends up happening, and this is true, you'll notice this, a lot of draft picks in the second, third, and fourth round who are super highly offensive defensemen don't actually end up playing in the NHL. It's the guys who were grinders in the OHL, the W, the Q, the NCAA, those European development leagues that end up being successful because they actually can hold the fourth down. Like, people forget, some defensemen get paid $4 or $5 million a year simply to break the puck out of their zone and to not turn the puck over at the blue line.
Yeah.
And that is an undervalued asset in hockey.
Yeah, no, we also got a lot of players that, a lot of injuries, a lot of people are coming back from injuries. McDavid's out with an injury right now. Doesn't look like he's going to be out for too long. Seems to be like almost like a carbon copy of last season. We've got Matthew Barzal out for 4 to 6 weeks as well. Macklin Celebrini just got activated off IR, so he's coming back to the Sharks after only playing one game with 2 points. But I feel like people have got some pretty good hopes for him. The Sharks definitely need some saving grace or something right now. I don't know what they need, but
they need him to sell out another game. They have had a rough time with that. We watched the San Jose game the other day. And I think that stadium was more empty than your typical junior C rank on a Friday night.
Who were they playing?
I think it was Colorado.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
But it was painful to see. I've never seen such an empty arena. But on the note of injury, Kyle, you brought something up that was really fascinating the other day, which has to do with Pettersson on the Canucks.
So, I mean, there's tons of, advanced analytics on sports, and we don't usually, really get into that stuff, but I thought it was super interesting. Someone broke down Elias Pettersson, advanced analytics, and trying to explain why he's been underperforming this year, because Elias Pettersson just signed a huge contract with the Canucks. So Canucks are pretty worried right now. He's not performing. I think he's got 3 or 4 points in the last 12 games, and he's -4. So he's not, and he also hasn't looked good. That's the other thing. And so some people dug into his stats, and what they found out is that the NHL tracks players' top speeds every game, and they also do an averaging, so they kind of know how fast each player skated every game, and they measure it in a couple ways. I think one of them is the bursts. So usually a player will only have Pettersson, for example, usually averaged 2 to 1.5 full speed bursts per game, or boosts of full strength skating basically. Right now, he's only averaging 1 or less of since 2 years ago, where he was averaging 2 per game. So that already tells you he's skating a bit less. His top speed while skating is a couple years ago and last year previous was about 23 miles an hour. Right now, it's 20 miles an hour. So he's been skating significantly slower than previous years. And the other one that's pretty concerning is his shot velocity. Normally, he has about 40, 50 shots that are above 90 miles an hour per season. And his average is fairly high, around that kind of above 80 miles an hour. Right now, he's only had a handful of shots that are above 80 miles an hour, and he's had 0 above 90. Mm. So that tells you he's shooting way slower than normal. All of these things lead to someone suspecting an injury. He's had problems with his back. So the theory is that his back's acting up right now and he's just not be able to play. But that's definitely not good news for the Canucks.
No, I mean, brutal. They're a team that I was not too high on. I kind of thought last year was a bit of a fluke. So
I did too.
I don't know. Maybe
they do have some good
guys. It's fair to say that this is a fluke with Pettersson partially injured, but
they blew some games at the start with Seloss that just had an absolute bomb of a start. My goodness.
Yeah, he's not playing very great.
No, he might get sent down actually.
Yeah.
Is that what people are saying?
Yeah.
I think it'd be good for him, honestly.
He's good reset. He's young.
You know, getting sent down to the minors never hurt anyone except Jack Campbell.
He never got out of that. Yeah. Wait, what's he doing now? Is he still on the A?
Oh, he's Tostito.
Tostito.
Is he in the East Coast?
No, I think he's in Detroit or Boston's minor leagues.
Yeah. Ooh. He wasn't playing very well in the A either. That was the thing.
Yeah, he got hurt by that big time. But also, What were we going to say? Oh, Ovechkin and Crosby. What a resurgence they're having now. Oh, my goodness. Sidney Crosby in his last three games has picked up 4 goals and 3 assists. OV, 37 goals away from the great one's record. I mean, look, Adam and I give each other a hard time about this. Adam thinks that Ovechkin's good. It's because he's really pro-communist Russia. But, I'll defend a good old Canadian lad any day of the week. I'm proud to say I'm Canadian. But really fascinating. I mean, what are your thoughts? You guys think OV has it in him this year? Do you think he can really put up 37 goals, or is it going to take him an extra season?
I just want to say Ovechkin and Crosby may have the same amount of points, but Ovechkin's done it in 2 less games. Just putting that out there. Communist or not, Alex Ovechkin is still better than Sidney Crosby.
That is just factually untrue.
I think his lazy boy is calling to him, and he's trying to retire early, and he's desperate to hit that goal counter, so he's just hustling right now. But honestly, I think he's still going to have to do another season.
Yeah,
to be completely honest, I think there's another season he's going to have to do. He can, you know what? I doubted him a little bit before. I think he will get the goal mark. It'll be a bit of a slug. He'll have to do one more season, likely, and I think he's going to retire quite quickly after that. I think
like as soon as he hits it, he'll be done. Like I don't think he's really messing around. He already won a cup. He's not.
I mean, actually, he has all the accolades he needs.
I don't think he's going for another depth run or something. No.
Do you think he'll ever leave Washington?
No.
Oh, you mean move back to Russia and raise his kid?
Or I'm thinking like maybe go play in the K.
Yeah, he could do that.
But you have to think like, what's the point for him now? He's dominated the best league in the world. Other than Crosby being better the whole time, but
I don't think he would play a lot. I don't think he'd be like a regular roster player on the K. Like, there's no way he's gonna be like practicing 5 times a week or something. Like,
yeah.
Although he could be pretty good with some Russian gas.
Yeah, maybe. But I could see him showing up and just get. I mean, he'd probably do some events. I don't know. I mean, maybe he'd play, but
yeah, I don't know. I see, because like Kovalchuk and Datsyuk, they went back and they played.
But did Datsyuk go back because he was older, because he just wanted to return to Russia?
No, Datsyuk went back because he wanted to return to Russia. But Kovalchuk went back because he wanted to return to Russia, but then came back to the NHL and then went back to the KHL and then retired. So, I mean, like, I don't know. Maybe it's not as serious for these guys, but...
Well, what do you guys think? Is the KHL better than the American Hockey League or no?
Yeah, I would say. I would say the KHL is
KHL's pretty good. KHL was actually, I mean, like... Kirill Kaprizov like proved it, that it's kind of a league that's been like, obviously it's given a fair amount of respect, like it's the only league that has a comparable like weighting to the NHL in terms of drafting, but a lot of people actually feel like it was actually super undervalued until like Kaprizov came over and people realized like, holy smokes, there's some really good players that are in that league that just don't get like noticed.
Well, Gino was there first, right? Malkin played 2 years in Super League, as he told Crosby. I mean, that's why he gets to go out last. Because you said me 3, you 1. You guys know that story?
Yeah. Speaking of the KHL, you know who's cooking is Ivan Demidov, Montreal Canadiens prospect. He's top 5 in points as an 18-year-old in the KHL. And he's playing on an interesting team with Yevgeny Kuznetsov and Tony D'Angelo. So Tony D'Angelo, kind of an NHL bad boy, kind of finding his footing in Russia, and Kuznetsov, you know, he likes to hit the slopes. So he's over in the KHL now, where this maybe it's a little looser over there. So who knows? But yeah. I think it's a good environment for the kid to grow up in. Demidov, I think, is going to learn some great habits.
Nothing will faze him in Montreal.
Nope.
Yeah.
No. He will walk up to the top of Mont Royal and just think it's a normal day. Nothing along the way will faze him whatsoever. That's a good thing.
Someone else that's a kind of a nice story, Arturi Laikkanen, who's been struggling with injuries for the last couple of years. The captain originally of the Avalanche, like super well liked player, but he just couldn't come back with a shoulder injury for a while. Just got activated from IR. He's going to play the next upcoming game, I think tomorrow, for the Avalanche. And he's been slotted on the first line, actually.
Oh, that's cool. That's cool. No, Habs legend. Sent us to the cup final.
Yeah, so what Kyle's not saying here is he's being humble. Kyle foresaw this happening. He picked him up in fantasy. Well, this guy was still on the IR in the late rounds of the fantasy draft, and now he's laughing in everyone's face because they're freaking out. He knows he's about to surge on ESPN fantasy. That's what's really going on here.
I mean, the reason why I knew he was coming back this year is because he had that press conference after last season when the Avs were eliminated from the playoffs, and he had the decision, either was he going to retire right then or say he's coming back for the next season. And he stayed on with the Colorado Avalanche and expressed that he definitely wanted to play again. So, I mean, there's no reason to expect why he would say that and just not play the next season. So,
was his injury that bad that it was like?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he did like a reconstructive surgery on his shoulder.
The issue was, I think it wasn't like he could have physically played probably, but the chances of him re-damaging it were so likely that he would have played and then re-hurt it and then just been toast again, right? See. So like it took a long time for him to get to a point where he could like confidently play and not be like super injury prone.
Okay, all right.
I mean, it's difficult when you injure your shoulder in hockey too. That's probably the thing that gets hit the most.
Yeah,
I mean, anytime you get rubbed off on the board, just shooting too, rubbed off on the boards. Honestly, just jumping over the bench, you still kind of put a lot of pressure on your shoulder.
If you have a shoulder injury, you feel tingling in your arm and you can't move it properly, right? Yeah, I can't imagine trying to be stick handling at an NHL level with that kind of immobility in my shoulder. But
no kidding. But just in the interest of time, let's also talk about the World Series. Yankees did not do so good. I mean, Adam, you know a little bit more about baseball than the rest of us, so maybe I'll let you lead the charge with this one. But what were your thoughts on that World Series?
Yeah, no, I thought it was a good World Series because I hate the Yankees, so I really wanted the Dodgers to win. But the Yankees fell down 3-0. I mean, losing the first three games in the World Series is never a good idea, as no team has ever even forced a game six from being down 3-0 in the World Series. Usually that's the case because in baseball, especially the World Series, usually the two teams are very evenly matched, and it's very rare that a team jumps out to a 3-0 lead, let alone a 2-0 lead. So this was a unique one, but the Yankees did force the Game 5. They won Game 4 to stay alive. And then Game 5, like, I was convinced that the Yankees were going to force Game 6 for the first time ever. They were up 5-0. And then just an utter collapse happened. There was a huge play in the outfield the inning before where Aaron Judge stole a home run. Like, he caught this crazy catch and brought it in from the right out the warning track. And then the next inning, he drops a routine fly ball, like, just completely muffs it. Like, I couldn't believe it when I watched it. And then countless errors, the shortstop threw it to third in the dirt, allowed a runner to move up. Then an easy out, a roller to the first base side, and then no one is covering first base. Cole, the pitcher at the time, did not cover first base. Rizzo, the first baseman, thought Cole was going to cover it. Just complete discombobulation going on. It was a rough inning to watch. Even if I was cheering against the Yankees, it was still gross to watch because that's just not how baseball should be played, especially in an elimination game of the World Series. Like, I don't know. It was tough to watch.
So people are pretty intrigued by what happened because the last time a team gave up a game in the World Series being up 5-0 was the New York Yankees in 1913.
Wow.
111 years ago. They are the only team to make that fatal error more than once.
I mean,
or even once.
And they're the winningest franchise. So, I mean, I guess they've got to have their... They've won so much, I guess they've got to lose a little bit, right?
I guess that's Montreal's motto, too, now.
Okay.
Hockey.
All right.
So let's talk about football. We got about 30 seconds left here. What's a brief update?
All I know about football is I just saw this crazy clip of this guy jumping over someone's head backwards, like in a vault. You see that?
Oh, George Pickens?
Yeah. What on earth?
George Pickens. I'm going to talk about George Pickens for a second because he's my favorite football player, okay? He's on my fantasy team. He's iconic for when he got drafted. He was like just looking at the TV slouched with a shiesty mask on. And I'm like, this guy he's a character. And he does way too much on the football field. The thing Kyle's expressing is he just suplexed a guy that was already on the ground, like just jumped, like back landed on him. I don't know. Crazy stuff.
For no reason.
Yeah. He's got like black Air Force energy. You know what that means? You know, the kid around school, hot Cheetos, black Air Force. You know, that's what George Pickens is. That he is something else. I don't know. He's a Steelers wide receiver. And I know I promised my housemate Josh that I would shout out Drake London. Drake London is a great wide receiver on the Atlanta Falcons. He's having a great year, very underrated. I think I saw
that one too, but I saw another one. Like it was like I can't remember who this player was, but he did like a 360 around someone and then he was facing backwards. There's three players running at him, and he jumped straight up, and the guy went between his legs, and he just kept on running. I don't know if this is a brand new clip I just saw, but
oh man, I must be new. I don't know which one you actually.
And then all I could think of was like, this guy's getting drug tested immediately after this game. He literally flew up. Like, that had to be a 50-inch vert. I don't even know what that was. No, but
some of the hurdles are insane. Insane to certainly watch.
Well, unfortunately, I think that's all the time we have for today, ladies and gentlemen. But just before we end this podcast, I'd like to make a special shout-out to one of our beloved guests. It's his birthday today. He wrote into the show, Patrick Burke. I hope you're having a great day. It's really kind of you to express your support to us in written paper. And ladies and gentlemen, if you want to write us a letter as well, just write to cfrc.ca, and they'll know exactly who to send it to. But we'll see you next week on Plugged in My Ears.
Love playing board games?